This is a HeadGum Podcast.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable.
Hello, halflings. It's me, Liv Kennedy. I almost said Jasper William Cartwright. That's not who I am.
Jasper William Cartwright.
It's me. Today, I'm Jasper. I'm Liv Kennedy. And I am joined today by...
Jeremy Cobb. But I just realized I don't have my nickname list up.
Fantastic.
Let me find that.
Also, I use she, her pronouns.
Liv, what are your pronouns?
So yeah, fun. Yeah.
Liv, while I'm looking this up, what are your pronouns? Yeah.
I love how this is like a classic intro disaster, but we keep plowing on. You this always hear the first take.
Yeah. Such a strong start. Just really good.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for your support.
Thank you.
Mystery guest.
yes, mysterious voice.
Mysterious voice.
Okay, so Joshua Hunnix calls me Jeremy Timbers, like Shiver Me Timbers.
Oh, that's very good.
Thank you, Joshua.
But now we can talk to our mystery guest, Jeremy.
Yay!
Yay!
Okay, everyone, the hype is real. We are joined today by YouTuber, cosplayer, singer, game writer, and my mom, Ginny D.
Oh my god!
This is the wrong dungeon and the wrong dragon.
Full prince vibe? Woof!
This makes them even more black.
Cake glitches and pitches.
And lands in the cusp of a teaspoon.
Oh, no.
On a nat 20.
No!
You think this is just a game?
That's disgusting and I love it.
Yeah. We're about to get into something real big now.
They're going nuts in Halfling Stadium.
They are losing it. And I forgot that Ginny was your mum. Hi, Ginny.
That's why I'm here. You know, I'll do anything for my son.
Aww.
Thank you so much, Mom.
So
for
nice.
By.
It's so sweet.
I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's so exciting to be here.
We're so delighted to have you. Like, I've been a fan for years and years. Your content is fantastic. Like, not to, you know, just put you on the spot, but you're amazing, and we all agree. So thank you so much.
Yeah, you make excellent stuff. And you know what? You know what, Liv? Oh. I know we didn't talk about it.
What?
Should we do a lore drop?
Oh, God's sake, Jeremy! Please explain.
Ginny, I have to explain this. Normally, it was something that Erica Ishii, I think, came up with.
Yeah.
That when we have guests, I guess we always have to do it too.
We have to do it. And this
you
is
say
where it
a random, weird
difficult.
Thing about your life that has no, we're not allowed to ask for any contextual questions.
Mm.
You just say like a, this thing happened to me or I did this thing once. And we're not allowed to ask for any details as to what occurred. We've done it so many times now that the halflings have almost run out of interesting
I'm
things
not
to say
that
about our
interesting,
own lives.
Like is the thing, like five things have happened to me in my entire life, you know? So
it's true. And know? Three of them were on this show.
Exactly.
Does it have to be interesting?
It could be boring.
Yeah. If you want it to be boring, it could be boring. Yeah.
If you want to tell a really boring fact, maybe we can tell boring facts about ourselves that have no context.
I'm just trying to think of something interesting that I like haven't already talked about, like mined for content. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
Yeah.
Every facet of my being has been mined.
Yeah.
It's cool.
That's true. I think, well, I'm trying to think, let's see, the very first one that I ever did, I do know this. This is probably also the most interesting one I ever said, was that I once talked an international fugitive out of sneaking into Karl Marx's tomb.
What?
I feel like I would have.
Yeah, that's 100%.
Remember.
There's not a word of exaggeration in that.
That. And yet I don't. So.
I think that was the very first one I ever told.
Dang.
Okay.
It was all downhill from there.
That was the peak. That was
that
it.
Was. Okay.
Oh, okay.
This is, I don't know if it's interesting, but it's not the most boring thing. I once made a friend while on an exchange program. And as I was telling my friends at school about the friend that I had made on the exchange program, the friend from the exchange program messaged me to tell me that they were in love with me.
Oh,
like, during the conversation. This occurred.
That was not where I was expecting that to go.
Oh my gosh.
It was very weird. It was a very weird situation because I was not expecting that.
Yeah.
But that that happened as I was I'm like, oh, I met this person, blah, blah, blah. Then they started messaging me and I was like, oh, look at that. And I was like, oh.
Oh no.
Well, this took a turn.
Goodness.
Oh. Wait, I think I've heard you speak about that in a different context, but so I think I know some context. But yeah. I'm gonna move on to mine, which is like pretty beige. I once auditioned for the TV show Skins in Bristol, where it is filmed. That's what I'm going with.
Nice.
It was unsuccessful.
I think it's cool.
Thank you. Yeah. All right.
This is not an I once, but it's related to me. I'm just going to, this is the best I can come up with right now.
We put you
once
on the spot.
Mm-hmm. My dad was sitting next to Mike Love from the Beach Boys on a plane, and he Mike Love that I am a singer before he knew that it was Mike Love. So one of the Beach Boys once heard that I'm a singer.
Oh my God. Like a collaboration's imminent, I'm sure. Like
The minute that he heard that he was sitting next to the father of a singer, I'm sure he was like, "We gotta team up."
Wow! Oh my God, you're so right.
He was like, "Look, we're thinking it's 2000 whatever. We gotta expand. It's now the Beach People."
The Beach you know what I'm People. Saying?
I love that. Yeah. Oh my gosh! I'm just imagining your dad whacking out like a recording of you singing, just like, listen. She's so
I mean,
good.
That would be very like my dad. The whole reason this even came up is that my dad spent the entire flight just talking to this guy about his own stuff, and then at the end he was like, "Why? You're wearing a Beach Boys hat." Like, that's cool. And he was I am in the Beach Boys.
I am a Beach Boy, in fact.
Yeah, classic.
Oh, wow.
That's incredible.
But my dad is like
my biggest.
I'm also
a huge Beach Boys fan.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So as soon as you said Mike Love, I was like, what?
Yeah.
Oh.
That's so funny. Yeah. My dad is like my biggest, you know, advocate. He's always telling strangers about what his daughter does. So
yeah.
It's like not unusual for him. The only thing that's unusual about that story is the Target.
Yeah.
Way to go, Papa D.
Yeah, exactly. So sweet.
Way to
I love
that. Be a supportive
father. Heck yeah.
Ginny, before I launch into an extended diatribe about Mike Love and his relationship to the Beach Boys during their most artistically fruitful period, please, I'm going to turn this interview back onto you and say, can you please give us your nerdy origin story? How did you come into this nerd life? What's the path you took?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question because I think I took somewhat of an unusual one. I'm not one of those people who's like, oh yeah, I've been playing D&D since I was 10 or anything like that. I was a different kind of nerd growing up. I was like a nerd in that I was a weirdo and nobody liked me, but I wasn't, I read a lot. Like I have always been a big bookworm. And I liked fantasy, you know, I liked reading fantasy, but, I didn't like do stuff like D&D. I didn't like, I don't know. I've never LARPed. Like I was more of a solo at home alone reading my fantasy books kind of nerd. And then I got involved in theater in school, in high school, and in music. And that was what led me to other nerds in that I sang at the Renaissance Festival. And that was the first time that I ever did anything that was like a true nerdy thing. And I mean, I wasn't even like a, you know, I came to like Doctor Who and Star Trek and stuff very late in my life. And then when I started working at a Renaissance Festival, that's when you meet all the deep nerds. And that transformed my entire life. So after that point, I got into all kinds of things that I now love, movies and TV shows and stuff that that have become important to me. And I played D&D for the first time while working at the Renaissance Festival. And that was in like 2010 or something, maybe?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You got into D&D way before I did. I got into it in 2018.
I did not get into D&D then. I played for the first time at Renfair, and I was like, this is terrible.
Like, oh, no way.
It was not good.
What,
it was
zero, like, 10. What edition? Do you know?
I have no idea. Honestly, I have so little memory of it because it was like 9:30 p.m. with 10 people in a pop-up camper trailer, and they were like, you know what we should do? We should play D&D, which is the worst idea.
Like, imagine going to a group of people who have never played D&D before. Like, I'm going to teach you right now.
Right now. Whoa. Starting in the evening where half of these people have been drinking, and like, it was such a bad idea. Like, somebody helped me make a character sheet. I don't even remember what class I played. I didn't understand any of it. And then, like, because there were so many people and none of us knew what we were doing, we weren't really able to accomplish anything in the time that we played. It was just a very poor introduction.
That makes
sense. I was like, well, this is terrible and I'm never doing this again. And then it wasn't until when was my first time playing D&D after that? It's like 4 years ago or something. So it took me a very long time to come back around to it.
Take the
and
plunge
what
again.
Brought me back to it was that I watched Critical Role and I was like, a friend recommended it and I was like, that sounds weird, but I might as well have something to listen to while I sew, because like I was listening to a lot of podcasts. And then I was like, oh, I understand how D&D could be incredible.
Yeah. Okay.
Did you start with campaign one or two?
I started with campaign one.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think my D&D experience was somewhat similar in that I first heard Critical Role before I had ever actually played D&D.
Yeah.
It was, and what really got me into the hobby was much more AP shows and then getting to actually play it. I was like, aha, because I brought the mentality from those AP shows. That's like, oh, we can tell stories and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah. And I never would have gotten into it from like the wargaming perspective of things. Like that's just not really, it's not my jam.
Not your thing.
The mechanics are secondary to me. They facilitate the story, but I'm there for the story.
Yeah, absolutely.
That seems to be how TTRPGs as a hobby has really been moving, is more like less mechanics heavy and more story based.
Yeah.
Like with a lot of the big games that come out these days seem to be much more story based and story driven rather than mechanics driven.
I mean, I've noticed D&D, like they're bringing out or have brought out their own skirmish game, which is like a war game version of like of D&D combat and stuff. So like, I feel like they are moving away, which is a moving away from that kind of being the main reason why you play. So
Yeah. I'm curious about what, can you name like one of your favorite fantasy series from way back in the day when you were a kid reading all those books?
Oh yeah.
As somebody who also enjoyed reading fantasy from time to time as a child, I'm curious if we had any overlap.
Yeah. To this day, one of my favorite series that I discovered in like middle school is Garth Nix's, The Old Kingdom series. Sabriel is the first one.
That's a name that rings the bell. Yeah, wait, let me look this up.
Yeah, Sabriel's the first one. It's about necromancers that use music to access their necromantic magic.
That's sick.
Yeah, the protagonist is a specific kind of necromancer who's like the only good guy necromancer who puts the dead back into death. And she has a bandolier of bells across her chest, and each bell like controls the dead in a different way. It's sick. It's like, I love creative magic system, and that series has a great magic system.
Oh, I love that. I was like, literally, I read all the time when I was young, but I was a basic bitch and I literally just reread the same things over and over again. Like I read all the Harry Potter series. Fuck TIFFs. And the Twilight series and Stephanie Meyer's The Host, which is just one that she wrote like a one-off.
The Host was actually good. Like Twilight was not good, but The Host was good. And I read Twilight. I liked Twilight at the time. But looking back, it was not good. But The Host was like
that was like such a creative idea for a story as well. Like the movie is fine. I mean, it has Saoirse Ronan in it and she's fantastic. It was fine. The book really, really good. I quite enjoyed it. Those are the three books I read. So that's me.
Did y'all ever read Aragon?
Mm-hmm.
Like the Inheritance? I guess the Inheritance Cycle? I never finished it. I only read the first two books.
My partner's a big fan.
I remember really loving Aragon when I was a little kid. And then by the time the second book came out, and then like during the wait for like the third book, I kind of fell off because I started to be like, hey, wait a minute. This is the same plot as Star Wars. I don't like this anymore. It is like, it is literally the, it's like farm boy in a remote part of the evil empire discovers that he got the heritage of like an ancient order of knights who have special weapons. And then the emperor sends people and destroys his farm. And the crazy old guy who lives nearby takes him under his wing. Cause it turns out that guy is part of the order of knights. And he starts to learn magic under that guy.
I guess
he has a skirmish. Yeah. Like it's the same exact plot. Yeah. And then even the second book even ends with like a big familial revelation where it's like, this bad guy was such and such the whole time. Like it was like, whoa.
Go ahead. I was just gonna say, didn't he write it when he was like 15 or 16 or something?
Yeah, he wrote the first one when he was 15, I think.
That's why I think we shouldn't publish the books we write as children, because they're not gonna be good.
No, exactly.
Give it a few more years to cook.
Yeah.
I went back and looked at like a book I started to write when I was like 17. Oh my God. Oh, she was cringe. She was so cringe. She was like, the love interest was like an angel guy. It was bad. Self-insert, big time. Yep.
I did like years of NaNoWriMo when I was in high school. So I have all of these like complete terrible manuscripts. And I was also one of those kids who like, I would go find the website online where you could send them the text and they would print it in the form of a book. So my parents still have these like print copies of these unedited, just like garbage books. Every time I see them, I'm trying to think of a way to get them out of their house so that they don't have them anymore. Because it terrifies me that they exist.
Showing Steve. He sits next to Stephen King and like, just my daughter, him, like no, my daughter. No, wrote.
My daughter's a writer.
Oh God.
Oh my God. Yeah, no, I fully understand that feeling. I wanted to ask Ginny. What got you into like being a nerd? What got you into like content creation, like nerdy content creation in particular?
Well, I've always been a person who, when I like something, I want to like put my hands on it and make something with it. So I used to do like Disney fan dubs on a YouTube channel when I was 14 or whatever. I've like run role playing forums and stuff like that. It's so funny that I started this off by being like, I wasn't a traditional nerd. And now I'm thinking of all the ways that I was very much a traditional nerd.
So many people who have been on this podcast have been like, oh yeah, I was in role play forums. And I was like, I'm like, oh my God, I wasn't the only one. Okay, thank God.
I ran one of the biggest Dragon Riders of Pern role play forums on pro boards for a while there.
Wow.
I'm just like a big project person. I like to do, whenever I come up with an idea, I want to like do it in the biggest way possible. So yeah. I would like start playing on someone else's roleplay forums and be like, I have so many ideas about how I could do this better. And then I'd go make my own roleplay forum. So because of that, I ended up making YouTube videos I started making YouTube videos with some friends from the Renaissance Festival because I just like, actually my YouTube origin story is so silly. I was in a Tumblr like Harry Potter fan community. TERFs suck, so we don't do that anymore. But at the time, we didn't know. And
yeah, we've all been there.
Yeah. I was like, you could do stuff to earn points for your house. And I was in Ravenclaw. So I was like, I got to earn points for Ravenclaw. Ravenclaw was behind. So they were like, here's how you earn points for your house. You like make content. And so it was like, take a photo in Ravenclaw themed clothing or like something like that. And I was like, I'll do you one better. And I wrote a Ravenclaw-themed parody of Rebecca Black's Friday.
Oh my God.
Whoa.
And then I made a video for it. This was my first year in college. So like in my dorm, I like filmed.
Did this do well, Ginny? Did this do well?
Well, yes. So I put it on YouTube in order to like link it on this Tumblr thing. And then it went kind of mini viral. Not what we would call viral now, but at the time, viral, which was like 200,000 views or something like that.
A feel like I'm definitely one of those 200,000, though. I feel like it's like buried deep in my mind. I'm like, wait a minute.
Whoa. Yeah. And it was like, you know, it was like on the Yahoo News homepage and like just weird stuff like that that happened with it. And then everybody was like, please make songs for the other houses. And at first I was like, no. I did it for my own house. Make your own song.
Make your own song, exactly.
But I had
Come on, Hufflepuffs, let's
go. This was when I was working at the Renaissance Festival, or not when, but between, because that was summers. But I had my Renfair friends at the time, and they were like, well, why don't we make some videos? So we started making videos for the other houses, and we started a YouTube channel in order to do that. And then ended up making stuff for like 2 years or something on that channel that fell apart and ended, and I already had the bug where I wanted to make stuff online. So
yeah,
that's how I got into it. And then I started making my own stuff, and now I do way different stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also still sometimes song parodies.
What was the chorus of the Friday parody? I'm curious, because I don't see like an easy like two-syllable Ravenclaw associated
word. It's like,
word. Is it,
we're
like,
Ravenclaws, Ravenclaws, we're the smart kids, we're Ravenclaws. Okay.
Yeah. No, I've seen this. No. As I said, I was like also a Ravenclaw back then. I don't know what you would even call it. So I was probably like Googling things like, what can I get for Ravenclaw Pride? You know, like,
yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, yeah, it was not a clever song, really. But I went way harder than anybody else in that Tumblr group was going. So that was my goal.
Yeah. How many house points? Like 1,000 at least. I assume,
I hope that really did well for our house. I can't remember.
Ginny, now we've had one of our past guests, actually, Draconic, specifically mentioned how one of his major inspirations when it comes to character creation is actually one of your videos. Your I think it's 25 questions, either 25 or 50 questions that you ask when creating characters.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us about like how you developed that process? And also I'm curious whether you use them for NPCs as well as for PCs.
Sure.
Because I have seen the video and I think it's excellent, but I'd love for everybody else to hear the process of how you arrived there.
So my goal with that video was more like, what are questions that you could ask yourself about a character that you might not have already asked yourself? So it's not necessarily like, here are the questions that you have to know in order to like have a fleshed out character. It's more like, once you know the core stuff, like what do they want and what is stopping them and what are they afraid of, and, you know, all the like big character building stuff, you ask yourself these more sort of nitpicky, highly specific questions in order to start thinking of them more as like a whole person. And because when you have a human, like a real human person, you don't just have the big, deep stuff that you like talk about in therapy. You also have like, you know, oh, I like to walk around the house while I'm brushing my teeth, you know, like just little things like that are not something that you would ever think to develop for a character, but something that sort of makes them feel more real. And my goal with that set of 50 questions was like, how will these make you think differently about your character and make you think about them like a real person? So they're very sort of, a lot of them are very silly questions, you know? Like, what do you do if you see, what does this character do if they see a spider? Are they going to be like, oh God, ew, a spider. Or are they going to be like, I'm going to kill it. Or are they going to be like, I'm going to catch it and put it outside. You know, just little things like that, that do tell you something about a character, but that you wouldn't ask yourself normally.
Absolutely. Okay. That's like, it kind of like leads into different ways of thinking. Like, I mean, me, for example, I'm like an arachnophobe. So any character I make is going to just be like, not afraid of them at all. And just, you know, it's quite... I mean, brave for me, I suppose.
Yeah.
So like, yeah. And like maybe caring, like, you know, I could see like a druid being like, don't you dare hurt that spider. You know, like that's, you know, cool things to think about.
Yeah. And I think like with these questions, I like to use them either you can ask them during the character creation process, or I also find them to be great. Like getting into character questions to pitch one at a time before a session. So like when everybody gets together for a session, you open by asking everybody the same one miscellaneous question. And then everybody is thinking about their character and maybe builds something new into it before the session, and it kind of gets you into the groove. Like, and I do
like
think
hot
it's
seating.
Yeah, yeah. And I do think it's useful to ask yourself these kinds of questions for NPCs too, for like major NPCs. I like to give each NPC at least one kind of quirk that like won't necessarily come up unless characters choose to engage with them more deeply. But if they do, I like to have something on the back burner where I'm like, if they do decide to really talk to this shopkeeper, like about more than the prices, there's something there for them to uncover, you know?
Yeah. I do the exact same thing. Like, I like to have it be, it's always like a secret. It's always like they have a secret desire. Like they secretly wish to dance.
Yeah.
I love the idea of just a random shopkeeper who's like, I wish I could have been a dancer.
Yeah.
But instead I'm here selling potions.
Okay. Well, in our next actual play, Jeremy, I'm going to be interrogating every NPC you possibly put in front of us. Like I gotta find out this lore.
They're all just like, we all wish we could have danced.
Yeah.
Yeah, every NPC just dreams of being a dancer secretly.
Yeah. I think it's because I dream of being a dancer secretly.
Oh, no way.
I'm like, yeah, I wish I've openly said that I think life would be better if we all would break into fully choreographed tap dance routines drop of a hat.
That'd be great.
And I wish that I had the skill to do that. Just go for I'm walking down the street and I just burst into a dance and dance down the street for a little bit.
Oh, we can do that.
Absolutely.
We can make that happen.
I definitely can't do that, but I would love if other people did that.
Yeah. I'll learn tap for you. You know?
So, Ginny, what motivated you to come up with the questions in the first place? Was it for your players or was it for yourself?
It was for myself. I think most of the stuff that I like talk about on YouTube and show to everyone else is just stuff that I've thought of or come up with or researched for myself to try and improve myself as a player or as a DM. And I think with those questions, I was finding that I wanted to get deeper with my characters. I wanted to understand them more fully, especially inspired by stuff like Critical Role that got me interested in the real complexity of character that you can have when you play that character for such a long time. You get so much time with them. And I wanted to just get deeper faster. You know, I wanted like that connection with my character. And yeah, it just felt like I needed to know more. I needed to know the miscellaneous stuff. Because if you go into a session and you only know their deepest core desires or whatever, and then someone's like, hey, welcome to the tavern. What would you like to drink? I'm like, I don't know. What would my character like to drink? Does this character drink alcohol? Or is she like going to order tea at a tavern, or is she going to be like, can I please get a glass of milk? Like, I just want to know what she's like in that way.
Like a huge pint of milk. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Just but chug it.
With alcohol in the milk.
Yeah. Doesn't Fern do that? Doesn't she? I'm pretty sure at the beginning of campaign 3, she like asks for a shot of whiskey in a glass of milk or something.
That sounds about right for Fern. Yeah. That sounds in character for sure.
But see, that stuck with me because it's such a unique, it says something about her character, you know? And I think that's why I wanted to have these like little pieces for my character to be like, yeah, that's a real person. And like, she has quirks. She has things that are strange about her, or not even strange, just things that are specific.
There's like a character I've been playing for like a long time. I keep just bouncing her between different like universes and different games because I'm like, no one's gonna stop me from playing her. I need a long-winded campaign for her, but she hasn't found a home yet. But like there, because I've been playing her for so long, like I can answer questions like that like at the drop of a hat. And it's a shame that like other characters that I have, I don't have that knowledge of them as much. But like, yeah, it's definitely worth doing those exercises and really feeling connected to the character.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I did that 50 questions like video, which is literally just a list of questions and I read them off. And then I also have a link in the description for like a document. And it's sort of a silly video to watch because it's just me rapid fire, like question, 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 question. And the comments I got on that where people are like, man, could you just give us a second in between the questions, where I was like, I'm expecting you to pause it. Like, I'm not just going to stand there and wait. But I think that is actually what inspired me to do my point of view roleplay videos, where I incorporate questions like that interrogate maybe unexplored areas of a character. I incorporate that more into a scene so that not only do you get to answer those questions, but you get to practice answering them in character. You get to practice your roleplay. And there is sort of like more space to consider those things in context instead of just being like question, 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 like an interrogation.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you go about like, oh, apologies, Jeremy. Are you sure? Are you sure?
Yeah, please.
Wonderful. I wondered how you go about like tackling that for different races in specific, like in like D&D or in different role-playing games, like how do you tackle different ancestries, especially as it's something that's been kind of like in the forefront of our minds recently, I would say.
Yeah, well, I have never been a fan of this race has this personality. I just,
yeah,
I mean, it's stupid. Like, not only is it not only is it racist, but it's also stupid. Like, yeah. It's just not fun. Like, there's nothing to me that's like, oh, all gnomes should act the same way. That just, what, I just don't think that's an enjoyable way to play. I would rather that my characters be shaped, their personalities be shaped around the experiences that they've had. And so when I think about how, like, a character's ancestry plays into their personality, it's not like, oh, the handbook says that gnomes are like tinkering. I instead am like, well, okay, if gnome society, did this person grow up in a gnome society, or is this a gnome who grew up maybe elsewhere? And if they did grow up in a gnome society, then like, how did that shape them? Maybe they are interested in tinkering because a lot of gnomes do tinkering, or maybe they are bored of tinkering because a lot of gnomes do tinkering, you know, like I factor those things into my ideation process. But I generally don't let, and I don't know, some people on the internet don't like this, but I don't really let the things that are officially written about anything in D&D be a hard rule for me. I'm willing to upend pretty much anything if I don't like it or think I could do something more interesting without it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I do a similar thing when I think I tend to go so hard against the grain that like it's almost a problem. Like one of my favorite characters I play is like a paladin who's also a tiefling, and it's just like she's like so righteous and stuff, and like she was like had to go through like a kind of proving herself process to people, like, no, I'm a paladin, I'm good at what I do, and it was just me being like, yeah, no, you don't get to decide who she is just because she's a tiefling, you know, it makes no sense.
Yeah, and I think it can be nice to have, I mean, I as a, like, when I'm creating something, I like to have some constraints because I find that it makes me more creative when I have like something to be working around. If somebody's like, when I'm like a guest in a D&D game, like in a one shot or in a campaign, and people are like, you can play anything you want. Like, you don't need to pick a certain race or class. You don't need to fit into any sort of typical, like, specific story. That is really hard for me. I would rather that somebody be like, we really need, like, a melee fighter to balance out this party, because that at least gives me something to start from. And I do, like, sometimes use, you know, a D&D character's ancestry or race as like a starting point in some ways for a creative like concept. But I don't know. I have never been a big fan of like all tieflings are X or all gnomes are X or whatever. Although I will say that some of my staple characters, like my NPCs on my channel, are quite cliche because originally when I was creating my point of view roleplay videos and when I was introducing these characters, my goal was to have like if you're interacting with a jailer in a jail, in like a medieval fantasy jail, I want the jailer to be sort of like the most typical expected NPC that one might encounter in that situation. So I was like, I am creating like a big, beefy, mean orc barbarian. And that was just like the vibe that I was going for. But now looking back, like, that did lead me to create several characters that are now a staple part of my canon that are like the most stereotypical character you could create.
Yeah.
And so now I find myself going fully opposite to that. Like, my two barbarian characters are Nekrasha, the half-orc barbarian, and Penelope, the deep gnome mushroom farmer barbarian,
yes,
who is like
Penelope.
3 feet tall and it's like adorable. So
yeah.
Two very different.
I think, especially when maybe you're like starting off like a channel like that, I think you have to appeal to people with what they know, you know, and then afterwards, like, as is, you know, as has happened with you, then you slip in like, but what if you did it differently? And what if these cool things happened, you know?
Yeah. And in some ways, I think it has been fun too to take a cliche and develop that into a more complex character over time, because there's no way that any character can stay, well, not the way that I play. There's no way that any of my characters can stay like boring and cliche and flat and one note if I do a lot of stuff with them. They just naturally develop more stuff around them. I don't know.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
You're talking about, like, and how basically you don't like the stereotypical way that the various fantasy ancestries are often depicted because it can feel overly limiting. One of the things that I noticed, because I think I saw it in one of your videos where you were playing your half-orc barbarian, you were talking about how tough it is to talk with tusks in.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And that was making me think, because I was actually going to mention that. That was one of the questions. But one of the things is, like, if you actually have tusks, you probably would communicate differently.
Yeah.
Like, if you did, you know what I mean? If you had tusks that were preventing you from being able to close your mouth and move your lips the way that a human would, you probably would develop a style of communication that's way more, like, tonal or something else
that would
work around that. And that would be, like, a cultural thing. That is, I feel like, an interesting cultural development that isn't really factored in with these kinds of...
Yeah, and I completely agree. And so many races in D&D have unique physical features that are like, because, you know, it's not, because they're not like races.
Yeah.
The way that
species.
Tieflings having horns and tails, like that would affect the way that they navigate the world. Like tiefling doorways are probably going to be higher and bigger.
For sure.
Tieflings are going to wear different kinds of hats. If their tails are prehensile, what do they use them for? Like tiefling communication might include like tail movements as part of their body language.
Yeah.
I think those kinds of questions are fascinating and really fun to explore. I think that feels to me like such a different and more creative approach to differentiating between ancestries than like all gnomes like to tinker or whatever. I think that being like, how does it affect you to be 3 feet tall in a world where some people are 7 feet tall? Like, what does that mean? Yeah. How does that work?
100%. Yeah, do their chairs have backs? What about their pants? Like, because of the tail.
Yeah.
You can't be sitting in, like, it might be kind of uncomfortable to sit with, like, a thick prehensile tail in some of the chairs that humans would make. Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody asked me once, they were like, do you think that some tieflings have difficulty sleeping or get neck pain depending on, like, the shape of their horns? And I was like, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. What if it's like lifting their head off the floor and on their back, you know?
Some tieflings probably can't sleep on their fronts or sides if their horns are a certain shape.
Yeah. Like horns would probably also be like a part, probably play into like sexual attraction as well.
Mm.
Like if somebody's got some really impressive horns.
Real good,
like,
horns over there.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Look at that old shiny horns over there.
Oh, I love that.
You can see them like polishing.
Now I want to think about like, okay, what kind of slang terms would tieflings use to like refer to someone having nice horns? Because like we have so many slang terms for referring to people's bodies, like in a sexual context.
Fit.
Just stuff that people say. I'm sure the tieflings would have their own special horn.
That one's real curly.
Yeah.
They like the real curly horns. Yeah, it was real curly
those
over
are some
there.
Solid horns over there. Yeah.
Even the way you speak, if you have fangs, because tieflings mm-hmm. have like sharp pointy teeth. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you not speak differently if the risk of biting your tongue meant that your tongue doesn't work anymore?
You know,
like
what?
If you have naturally full, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So this is that. This is so funny because I think I have in some ways some unique like angles on these questions since I cosplay so much. So like I wear the horns and I hit them on doorways. So I think about the doorways because I'm like, when I wear Augury's giant horns, I hit stuff all the time with them. I hit my boom mic stand, you know, it's a disaster. And with the fangs, when I wore the fangs for Jester, for my Jester cosplay, and I have done so much speaking in costume as Jester just because the accent was like a big part of my cosplay. So I have a ton of experience like speaking as Jester with the fangs in, to the point where I have no noticeable lisp now with the fangs in, even though when you first start speaking with them in, everybody lisps a little, it's hard. I found was that Jester's accent actually does make it a lot easier to speak around the horns because her accent just requires like a very open-mouthed way of speaking. Like she has I don't know, it's something about the way that I speak as Jester has, there's a lot of room in the mouth. And that makes it so much easier to talk around the fangs. Like weirdly easier than using my regular voice with the fangs.
Like, I have to think that Laura Bailey just planned it out. She knew exactly what she was doing.
extensive research.
I would love to give her that credit. But I also think that she has said in some context that she is just a voice she did around the house to be silly, which also makes total sense to me as someone who has done silly accents around the house forever.
All the time. Yeah. Like I my neighbor's gonna think there's like several different people living here, honestly. But
So Ginny, we've talked a little bit about how cosplay has informed your understanding of how a lot of these fantasy species would actually behave or live. I'm curious, like how did you get into cosplay in the first place?
I did not know what cosplay was for a long time and just went very hard on Halloween and loved costume parties. And then when I met nerds and went to the Renaissance Festival and I wore costumes to the Renaissance Festival, and then my Ren Faire people were like, want to go to a convention? And I was like, I do not know what that is. And we went to my first convention and I learned about cosplay and I was like, oh, so you can just make and wear costumes whenever you want? And that was it. Then I was a cosplayer.
Yeah.
That was literally all it took, was just me figuring out that was a thing you could do. And
you start out cosplaying? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that I already knew how to sew. I learned to sew from my mom when I was younger, and I liked sewing, and I sewed my own Renaissance Festival costume and stuff. So I was already like a person who liked to sew costumes. Although cosplay made me much more experienced and more educated sewist than I was before. But I'm sorry, I was gonna answer your question and I immediately forgot it.
Oh, it's okay. I was just gonna ask, what did you start out cosplaying?
So my first cosplay was, I went to this convention, Starfest, which was a local science fiction and fantasy convention. It has now ended, which is sort of sad. It was a staple Denver thing. But it was a pretty small con, and I went with my Ren Faire friends for the whole weekend. Like, we went Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and I went on Friday in my regular clothes and saw everybody in their costumes, and I was like, I am wearing a costume tomorrow. So I wore, like, I think I cobbled together, like, a Mad Hatter out of my closet with just, like, weird stuff that I had going on, and a hat that I had made for a Halloween costume. And
cool.
And that was my, technically, I guess, my first cosplay. But other than me being like, I must wear a costume tomorrow, having just discovered cosplay, the first one that I actually like committed to and spent a long time on was Codex from the Guild, which I don't know if you guys have seen that web series with Felicia Day.
I've heard of it. Felicia Day was in that. Yeah.
Yeah. I would argue that it is. I don't know if I would argue is the right phrase here. I might be wrong, but to my best understanding, it is one of the first commercially successful web series, which is kind of like incredible. The beginning of
era. I think you're correct. Like there were, especially like it sounds like they had a full budget. Cause I remember in like the behind the scenes stuff for Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, Felicia Day mentions the Guild multiple times.
Yeah.
That was how I heard of it. But I mean, the fact that was in 2008. So like when they made all of that, yeah, it would have been one of the first.
Yeah, so I was a fan of the Guild. I was a fan of Felicia Day, and like the Guild was one of the main things that I knew her from at the time. And so I really liked Codex's costume. I thought it was pretty. So I spent like 2 months making that before Starfest the next year, as my first like big costume. But honestly, I never was a cosplayer who had like a theme. You know, there are people who are like, I'm an anime cosplayer. I do all anime stuff. I just sort of picked out stuff from whatever I was into at the time. And that means I've cosplayed like Disney princesses and like characters from movies and, you know, all kinds of stuff, characters from web series, games.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. So, like, oh no, go ahead, Jeremy.
Please. It's all you, Liv. You want me to do it?
Yeah, no, you do it.
Okay,
yeah,
I'll hop in. We're just like, you go. Do you, as somebody who has never cosplayed myself, and like even when I would be do like theater stuff and trying to think of specific costumes, my brain does not work with clothes. Like when I see the outfit, I'm like, there we go. But like, I find it very difficult to envision the specific clothing items that make sense for a specific character. How does one like practically go about not just cosplaying in general, but like cosplaying a fantasy species? Because oftentimes with a lot of your cosplays, you're like a completely different color. You're like completely green or completely red.
Yeah.
Like how do you go about doing that?
Well, first of all, I will say that I love doing body paint for fantasy costumes because I think it makes it so much easier to put together the rest of the costume because people are paying attention to the fact that you have a, like a wild rainbow skin color. So your costume does not need to be nearly as interesting or complex when you paint yourself a color. And
that's
I think that's a top
tip.
Now that I've said that, I feel like anybody who listens to this and goes back and looks at my costumes is going to be like, wait a second. She's not that good. Because you look at like Necrasha, for example, my orc character, she has like, she's wearing like leggings that I ordered online for a different costume and like a belt with a pouch on it. And then I made her top and then like put some fake fur over my shoulders. I've upgraded that costume now. She has like custom armor from a leatherworking shop that made it specifically for me, which is like incredible. And it's so beautiful. But like the early version of that costume was so, it was a closet costume, but it's like, because I was painted green, it looks very impressive. But I will say that when you do have like a body paint costume, you do have to think a lot about how you layer. Because for me, I don't like to paint my hands. I try to avoid painting my hands if possible. So either the character needs to have gloves, or I make gloves out of tights in the same color as the skin. And then I glue fake nails to them, which is a classic Homestuck tip. I did not do Homestuck stuff, but Homestuck cosplayers did amazing things for the body paint cosplay community with their creations.
They made a lot of advancements.
Yes, they did. And then also at one point tried to dye themselves colors with Sharpies in a bathtub. So they've done good and bad things.
Okay. Yeah. Ups and downs.
No.
But if you have those gloves that have like the fake nails on them to make it look like you painted your hands so you can touch stuff and not get paint on everything, you then can't use your hands anymore. And you also have to conceal, like for phones and stuff. And you also have to conceal the ends of the thing. I've lost track of all my words somehow over the course of this.
But like, I guess the stitches and where everything ends.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Right. Because like
the seams. That's
right. Like the edge of the tights, gloves or whatever needs to be concealed because it's like a line that'll show your skin, that it's not your skin.
Yeah.
So I have to think about stuff like that when I'm making costumes. Where, how am I going to cover up the edges of all of the stuff? How am I going to make everything work together?
Yeah, it's a lot of thought that goes into it. And honestly, the tip about like the body paint stuff, like going back and seeing like, oh, if your costume, you know, has been upgraded and stuff, that's great and all. But also, like for somebody who's about to enter a cosplaying space, it's a great tip. Just like, even if you're like, oh, I'm just going to like, cobble together a few things. Having a kind of like main like attraction on you, whether it's like the body paint or something else.
Yes.
That is actually a really good idea.
Yeah. One of my friends, Lizard Lee. Hey, Lizard Lee is their online username. One of my favorite cosplayers. Such an incredible crafter.
Lizard Lee.
Just like a, Oh, just so good. Everything they make is so good. And one of the tips that they gave me that I think about a lot is they told me about how they focus on the portrait zone when working on a costume. So if you're going to put a ton of detail into something or a ton of labor into something, it makes the most sense if that thing is in whatever will be captured with a portrait image, because that's what is going to be in the most images and the most close up. Because if you have a full body image, you're going to see like the hem of your pants or whatever, but you're not going to see it close up, and you're never going to have a close up of the hem of your pants. So if you're going to hand embroider something, don't make it the hem of your pants, make it the neckline of your shirt, you know?
I love that. That makes so much sense. Ooh, yeah. I've always wanted to kind of like get into cosplay, but like I'm not a particularly good sewer. Yeah, I like, but I mean, my partner is though. So I should really like, we've talked about like working on stuff together. Like, we would love to do like a Bo and Yasha cosplay at some point. That would be a lot of fun.
I love that. And what a fun way to bond too.
I know, exactly. Yeah. Like, well, I cannot believe I found such a big nerd, but yeah, along with me. But yeah, no, it's so Hey Lizard Lee, I definitely will check out, because I need to learn more. I want to do it.
Yeah, they're great. Yeah. They do a bunch of crafting stuff on their YouTube channel too. So like educational content, but also really fun. Educational makes it sound boring. It's not boring.
Oh, no. Yeah. Education can
it
be fun.
It is educational and fun.
And fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so how long does it normally take? Like, oh, if you were to say for the average cosplay, obviously the ones that you're doing are probably more elaborate if you're having to change your whole skin color and everything. But say for like a beginner cosplayer who was not trying to change their species, how long on average would you say it would typically take to create a costume? For most, and I don't know if that's really a reasonable question, because I imagine the range of work that you would have to do depending on the costume varies quite drastically. But still, I'm asking it.
No, you're right that it is a huge range, but I don't think it's an insane question to ask. Like, it's actually a question that I have gotten a lot, like in relation to cosplay, because I think the reason that people are so curious about it is that there are some costumes that clearly have like hundreds of hours of labor in them, and that is. That's just like a wild thing to wrap your head around. And I think that there are costumes that you can put together. I have made costumes in one day. I have made one day costumes several times. Sometimes as a challenge, other times just because they didn't take that long. And also I have made costumes that have taken like half a year. And of course it's like how many hours versus how many weeks or months is sort of different numbers, because obviously you're not spending 24 hours a day working on a costume.
Moment.
But a lot of them can take quite a long time, especially if they have the things that take the most time are either if you're doing any like hand embellishment. So I did a Thumbelina costume. I sewed a bunch of flowers and beads onto the skirt. I just hand sewed like 500 little flowers and tiny beads onto the skirt. I mean, that just took like several weeks of me doing that for hours while watching TV, you know? Like, it's just one of those things which takes a really long time. And then the other thing is, there are a lot of things in cosplay that just have to, like, dry or cure or whatever. And so that can stretch a timeline really far if you're like, okay, I have to do one coat of this and then let it dry and then do another coat and then let it dry and then sand it and then do another coat and then do a sealant and, you know, whatever. So I think that those things can really stretch the timeline on a project. But, yeah, I mean, I would say that my average costume probably takes, like, 15 to 30 hours total.
Okay.
I don't go that hard anymore.
Yeah, give yourself a break. You've done so much.
Yeah, back when I was like entering cosplay contests and stuff like that, I would do a lot more. But these days, I usually make the costume not because I am like trying to focus on the crafting process, but because I have a specific thing that I need and I can make it so that I have it, you know? Yeah. So I'm not like reveling in the creation process so much anymore.
Right,
yeah.
Right. This is a bit of a gear change, but it was something that I asked you about if we could talk about beforehand. I'm curious for both you and for Liv, because I ask you in particular because I've seen some of the ridiculous treatment that you have received online from people. I'm curious, as women online, especially on YouTube, because I wonder, I imagine it's bad everywhere, but YouTube can be YouTube can be rough. It's
the Wild West out there, yeah.
Yeah, what has been your experience as a woman in content creation, especially in the YouTube space, and even, I would say, in the cosplay space? And how would you say, I guess, your experience has been shaped by the fact that you are both women in these spaces?
Yeah, Jenny, please start if you wouldn't mind.
Well, how has my experience been? Not great. I'm gonna be honest with you. I think that the sexism is the worst part of my work, and I wish that it weren't as prevalent and as constant as it is. And I definitely feel like it is worse in YouTube and in the D&D space than it was in cosplay. In cosplay, I think in cosplay, I got more like objectification, just because not only is it just like, here are photos of me, you know, which is like, that's the content. So that makes sense. But also I think there's expectation around cosplay being sexualized just because so many cosplay designs and so many cosplayers are intentionally creating sexual content. So it's there's just sort of like, it's something that people associate with cosplay now. And I don't, like, to be clear, I don't think that women who make sexualized cosplay content are responsible for the bad behavior of the people who who sexualize me or others. But it's
not the
context,
fault of the victims. It's everyone else.
But it definitely adds to the context, I think, in the cosplay space. But in D&D, I have experienced a lot more of the kind of sexism that's like just people who assume or tell me that I don't know what I'm doing, that I shouldn't be talking about any of this, that I don't belong here. People making assumptions about just every sexist assumption in the book. That's a lot more prevalent in the YouTube space for me. What about you, Liv?
A similar thing. Like we were saying beforehand, like we're both the opposite ends of the spectrum on this. Like we've had like similar experiences, but like quite different as well. I think that like for me, because I'm also like, I'm a woman, I'm a person of color, I'm super gay, all of that stuff. Like, it's like, what are people going to focus down on now? You know? So like, it gets wrapped up in everything else, but there is also definitely a lot of like, you don't know what you're talking about. Like, I made a video for Dicebreaker that was just talking about like, what is the best edition of D&D? And so seeing me on the cover of that, we got so many people riled up. And obviously, like, I mean, I said 5e because, like, you know, that's, it's an opinion piece. That was my opinion. I still get comments to this day just like, you're wrong, and this is why you're wrong, and you don't know what you're talking about. And yeah, it's getting traction. So that's you know that I assume you know the feeling, Ginny, where it's like, it's engagement though, right?
The hard part about it is, I know that it's that all engagement is good engagement, you know, in terms of the algorithm.
In theory.
But I am not good at stopping myself from looking at it. That's the problem. Is that I just I like self-harm by reading comments that I know are gonna be bad about me. Like there are definitely times when I'll be scrolling through like Reddit and I'll see a thread and I'm like, someone's bringing me up, and I guarantee someone has brought me up in response to this thread in order to talk shit.
Yeah.
Like just judging by the title, I'm like, this is the kind of thread where somebody's gonna bring me up and talk shit, and I will click on it.
Yeah.
And see, like, why? Why do I do that?
It's so hard to not, though, because you're just like, well, I don't care, but I'm going to look. What if I can like use it to improve myself? Which it's never going to be something you can improve on. It's only going to be just complete nonsense.
And
so,
that's the hardest part, I think, is that we get this feedback that is not, it's not good faith. It's not about the things we're saying or the work we've done. But it's in disguise as if it is about the things we're saying or the work we've done. And I'm such a perfectionist and a people pleaser. And like, I'm so desperate to do a good job and I want to make everybody happy. And it just is, it's near impossible in my brain to separate the bad faith criticism from the good. I take it all in. And I hold it all in my heart, and it's not good because I think there is that thing that I know rationally, but that I can't seem to fathom emotionally, which is I will never make those people happy. The people who hate me because I am a woman, who think that I only have subscribers on YouTube because I am hot or whatever, those people are never going to respect the things I say, no matter what I say.
No, exactly. Like, if you're not a completely different gender, usually, then they're just going to discount you regardless. And you can't, that's not something you can change. That's not something you can improve upon. You are who you are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, there's no pleasing those people. So I completely get that. But
yeah.
Yeah, it's rough out there, basically, Jeremy. Thank you so much for asking.
No, I think it's important to highlight, and especially because I think if you haven't seen it or haven't talked to people who've experienced it, it can even like go over your head. Because like what you just said, Ginny, where they, a lot of the time, the comments that you receive are not necessarily explicitly saying, oh, well, she's a woman, therefore.
Right.
But it's like, you can taste it.
It's
like you can taste it, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the soup that they're pouring out has misogyny in it. You can smell it from here.
Yes.
It's just they put a spice in there that you can't, like, it's not obvious if you don't know what to look for.
And the thing
is, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, I now, from my many years of experience making content online and from the sheer volume of comments I'm getting at this point, I can recognize when there is a sexist flavor to a comment, even if it's not obvious, but other people don't have that same sense. And because of that, I have been told plenty of times that I'm overreacting to things or reading too much into things. And I sometimes will even respond to someone several times to force them to say what they're implying.
Yeah.
Just to prove to myself. Yeah. Just to prove to myself that I'm not crazy. Like, I mean, there was just a guy a few weeks ago that I should not have replied to. It's so stupid that I even exchanged comments with him. But he was implying over the course of these several comments that I am not an experienced DM, and that is why I don't show myself DMing on camera. And he wasn't saying that's
not your content,
but he was implying it. And finally, after several replies, he was like, I was basically like, you're not being subtle. I know that you think that I am not a good enough DM to have this channel. And he was like, yes, you're correct. I don't think you're as good a DM as you let people think you are. Sorry. And I was like, why did I draw this out of him? I didn't want to hear it. And I knew what he was saying from the very beginning. But sometimes it's like, I just need to prove that I'm not crazy.
Yeah, for sure. Like, as women, we're always just kind of like, it's a weird conditioning of like, I don't mean to like throw around the word gaslighting, but there are a bunch of times where it's like, okay, maybe I am overreacting about this thing. Maybe this was just a joke. Just a joke gets me all the time.
Oh,
like, it's
God.
Like, it be funnier.
Yes.
It's just a joke. my God. but yeah, so it's like, you completely condition yourself into thinking like, you know, maybe I am the problem. Maybe I don't deserve this platform. Maybe this, that, maybe that. It's, yeah. It's so annoying that we let these comments like get to us. And just to remind you, Ginny, that's not at all the truth. They are just jealous and being ridiculous. Just so you know that. I'm just repeating it.
Thank
just
you. Repeating it's it. Nice to hear.
Very good at what you
well,
do.
Well, and I was talking with Antonio from Pointy Hat, and he was like, you know, that's stupid. I don't have me DMing on my channel, and no one accuses me of that. Like,
yeah,
he straight up was like, it is 100% because you're a woman. Yes.
Yeah.
And even though I feel like I know that, it is nice sometimes to have other people be like, yes, that is why.
Yeah. Validation is so important. Like, sometimes you just need an outside voice to just be like, yes, no, you are correct. They are wrong. They're being a dick. Yeah.
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 Yeah, absolutely. I think what you were saying, Liv, I think a lot of that gaslighting, I think some of it is absolutely intentional, like from some people, because they will absolutely be like, well, I'm just going to, they're trying to seize on anything they can. Mm-hmm. But I think some of it is because they genuinely don't realize. Like the person, because they have not seen, they have not seen enough examples of this, or because they just haven't heard from people's actual experiences, they're unaware of how common those kind of attitudes are and that kind of treatment is.
Well, and I even think that a lot of the sexism is unintentional. Like, I don't think that I think a lot of these people think that they're giving me real criticisms, and they are not able to separate in their mind that they would be treating me differently and speaking to me differently if I were a male creator. I don't think they can recognize that, a lot of them.
Yeah. Because just like we've been conditioned to kind of like take on these and internalize these comments, they've been conditioned to kind of give them like and see things from this perspective. So we're like, it's a societal thing. It's not like people individually shouldn't be doing this, but it is a societal thing that has been established as we've grown.
Yeah.
Which is a shame.
Yeah.
Yeah. The you can see the same thing with racial undertones where like people won't register. Like I think I've talked about this on the show one time before. I was talking to a guy one time who was like, you know, it's not like a race thing, but when I'm walking along the street and I see a group of black males walking towards me, I cross the street. You know, it's just a statistic. You know, it's just a, and I, he says this to me, and this guy isn't even white, by the way.
Oh,
he's like mixed race. Huh, but like, it didn't occur to him, like, what he was saying was like, I consider them to be a more dangerous, inherently more dangerous group of people just because of their race. And it's like,
and that's why D&D stereotypes are harmful, because it's the same kind of attitude. But like, oh, in fantasy setting,
I can't imagine prefacing that with "it's not a race thing." Like, what?
What else is it? What else is it?
Yeah, it's. I think it's the same attitude where he has grown up in those mentalities for so long that it. Mm. He thinks he's being logical, right. But like it's like, well, bro, look where the logic is coming from, though.
Yeah, like, this can't... is. I mean, sorry, I keep interrupting you. I'm just
no, please,
I'm just
go excited, jump in there,
conversationalist.
Yeah, jump in there.
I'm all for it.
Because I was just thinking about how people will. Men will trip over themselves to talk about how booby streamers have an easy time on Twitch. But if you look at the top streamers on Twitch, they're all men.
It's all men. Oh my God. No, it's like you do not see a woman like far and wide. You do not see a woman. It's always just,
And they'll swear up and down that like women have it easier. Men will just watch hot girls on Twitch no matter what they do. Like they'll say they all don't. This stuff as if it is logic, as if it's reason. But the actual data, it makes it so easy to show that they're wrong. It's like when somebody told me that I wouldn't be successful on YouTube if I weren't a woman. And I was like, name three other female tabletop gaming YouTubers. I can, but only because I have looked for them.
So I've been seeking out my people. It's very hard.
Like, the most well-known TTRPG creators on YouTube, almost in general, are men.
Yes.
Like, almost all of them. And the vast majority of them are, I think, straight, cis, white men.
Yes.
Like, the large majority.
And most of the women that we, like, know in the tabletop space are from groups.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the same when it comes to, like, we were just talking to Critical Bard, and we were talking about how it feels like, and once again, I want to be very clear, this is a very pro-Abria Iyengar podcast.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We stand Abria.
But we have seen that the way that the industry has treated Abria is very similar to the way that it treats, like, other people in that position, where it's like, yes, you are the one that we will elevate, none of the other black women.
Yes.
None of the other, it, like, we
they've
won't,
like
we,
found
we, you
one,
get the one
so that they can check a box and they'll be like,
exactly.
Look at us. We have so much diversity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're so good. It's Abria. Look, everyone. She's bad.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
And she absolutely
deserves
to be in those positions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, there's no question of
but
that.
But she's not the only one.
Exactly.
No, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah.
She's phenomenal.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, just other people, give other people chances, you know?
Yeah.
Good idea.
Yeah. And that would show, like, if I'm sure that Abria has gotten some comments from people saying, well, you wouldn't be in that position if you weren't this or that. But again, if you look at all of the most well-known DMs, almost all of them are straight, cis, white men.
Yeah.
Like, still. Like, it's, yeah.
The argument is nonsensical. Like, we all saw the, I can't remember what the actual, like, event was. But you know the piece of marketing that came out recently? That was the top
yes.
people.
Yep.
Yeah. It was like a summit.
It was just like dudes. Eight white men in a row. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was like, this feels about right.
Yeah.
But also, what are you doing?
Yeah.
It's just the state of the industry. Like, it right there was, like, it in a nutshell.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, well, you know what? Let's try and turn it around.
Now that
we're all sitting here kind of worked up. Ginny, first of all, thank you so much for spending, taking time out of your busy day to come on our show and be here for such a wonderful interview.
Of course.
Before we wrap this up, there is a question that we always have to ask our guests.
Okay.
But we always request a tale from the table.
Ooh.
This is essentially a memorable experience that you have had playing TTRPGs. It can be funny, it can be joyful, it can be scary, it can be tragic, it can be triumphant. We've had the whole gamut. It can be heartwarming. Yeah, we've got anything you got that it really jumps out at you.
Man, my brain is full of so many possible stories. Okay, I'll tell you one from a DM perspective that I've been thinking about recently because I am working on this is from one of my D&D in a Castle adventures, and I'm working on writing it into a published, like a print adventure. So yeah, it'll be fun. So in my second year D&D in a Castle adventure, I had a vampire character named Rosary, who was a vampire who wanted to drink people's blood. And my players just like did not see her as threatening. Like something about her, they just wanted to be her pal. And she like was very, very clearly, very obviously trying to lead one of them away into a separate room. So that she could drink their blood. They were like, sure, let's go. And I was like, am I gonna have to attack this? Like, am I going to have to fully attack this character one-on-one in order to prove to the player that she's in danger? And thankfully her character's brother came over and stopped her. But by the end of the adventure, she had come up several times, this character. And by the end of the adventure, I was like, fine, I will just let her be the friendly vampire that you want her to be. And in the epilogue of the story, several of them formed a band, like a musical band, and we ended up deciding that Rosary was their agent and like went along with them and booked their shows and stuff like that. So that is my my tale from the table is Rosary the vampire monster turned booking agent.
Also, excellent name, by the way. Rosary is such a good
name. Thank you. My whole description for her was just bored sexy vampire. So that was the whole thing.
That's the thing. It's the Strahd / Astarion effect now, where people are just like, oh, you put a sexy vampire in. I see. So interesting. What if
also Edward Cullen?
I just exposed my neck.
Yeah.
I guess so.
Yeah. But just classic. I guess I shouldn't have assumed that my players would ever respond to a sexy vampire with anything other than interest.
That's the thing. You gotta know your audience. Like I would be the same. I'm a dummy, and I would let it happen. It's
That's
bad.
So funny. Sorry, that was a really short tale from the table.
It was great.
I'm sitting here because we've been talking about YouTube, and there's a really good video about the history of the lesbian vampire in fiction.
I can't remember
who made it, but it's a really I will have to find it and include it so people can go watch it. But it's a really good video about how vampire stories throughout history have treated sexuality, specifically when it pertains to lesbianism, really kicking things off with like the first Sheridan Le Fanu's Carmilla, and then like going through the 20th century to I think the most recent one it talks about is the movie adaptation of Carmilla from a few years ago, which if you haven't seen it, it's really good. It's very different in terms of how it engages with lesbianism than the book.
Cool.
The web series Carmilla is pretty pretty cool.
that was a fun one too. Anyway, thank you, Ginny, for being. I'll find that later. And
yes, send it to me. I would love to watch it.
I'll hit you
for research.
It's really good.
No, this has been a wonderful chat. I love getting riled up on a Wednesday afternoon. It's very fun. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me and for talking with me. And it was fun to talk about lighthearted stuff, and it's also fun to talk about the garbage stuff too, because it's nice to just be able to get it out there and hear other people be like, yes, that does suck, and it also happens to me. Because I feel like we don't talk about that very much because we're all trying to put on a brave face.
Yeah, friend. I feel like we need a support group, honestly. Like Wouldn't that be so nice? Yeah. You know,
I think it's also important for people to hear it.
Yes.
Because, like, again, if you don't know it happens, if you don't understand, like, if you don't see it, if you're not experiencing it, I think a lot of people are just like, yeah, I guess it kind of happens. I don't know. It's bad, y'all.
Yeah.
It's bad.
It do be happening.
It do be happening.
Yeah. Sometimes when people are like, I don't think you must get that many bad comments because I never see them on YouTube, I tell them that I moderate my YouTube and then I send them a screenshot of my muted words list on YouTube. And that changes their mind.
Yeah.
I found the video. It's called The Lesbian Vampire in Film, in parentheses, A Deep Dive by Verily Bitchy. Verily Bitchy makes really good videos in general.
I was going to say, I've watched a few first.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
And The Lesbian Vampire in Film, I'm gonna put a link to it in this chat and then also in the description. So y'all can go check it out later.
Everyone can join us. Yes.
Yeah. But Ginny, thank you so much for being here. And we hope to get to have you back on sometime. Maybe for some actual play or something else. We shall see.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
So if you've got anything you would like to plug at all, like tell people what to find you, got any cool things coming up?
You know, I don't think I have anything that's coming up soon enough that it would be useful to mention it, except that I always take January off of YouTube, so I will be back on YouTube in February. So, like, if you haven't checked out my YouTube, then this is a good time, because I'm about to have new stuff coming.
Ooh. It's a coming.
Yeah.
So that's youtube.com/GinnyD.
Correct.
Is that, heck, I got it. Yeah. I got it. Very nice.
Well, Liv, do you have anything to plug?
Sure, I could plug some stuff. What am I doing with my life? I am at Does Dark Magic on Twitter and pretty much every other platform. I always mention Twitch, twitch.tv/OliviaDoesDarkMagic, even though I barely use the thing. I need to get back on there. This is going to be my year to go back on Twitch. Also, we have a website, 3blackhalflings.com. Number 3, Black Halflings. And also you should check out the Patreon, because we've been putting a bunch of stuff up there and we're really getting back into it. Jeremy, you just had a chat about Animorphs and stuff and like did a solo pod on that. It's fun.
By the time this is out, there will be at least one more episode talking about Animorphs as well.
Wow, nice. Double Animorphs. What more could you ask
for? There's going to be several, honestly. If there are not already, there's a lot to cover with that series. I don't know if you ever read that one, Ginny, but there's a lot to unpack.
I was more of a Goosebumps girl myself.
Goosebumps girly. Love that.
Yeah. It is only through going back to Animorphs that I realize how insanely dark and violent that series was. Like, it is genuinely one of the darkest and most violent things I think I've ever read.
Well, you should listen in on Jeremy's thoughts at patreon.com/3blackhalflings, number 3 Black Halflings. And also I did a podcast with my partner Chloe, and we chatted about escape rooms and our love of them, and it was fun, and I had a fun time with my wife. So you should go and check it out. What about you, Jeremy?
All I really got to plug is you can follow me on Twitter at Jeremy Cobb 1, this Cobb with 2 B's, the number 1, and Instagram at the Cobbmeister. And if you want to see me on Twitch, where I stream multiple times a week, twitch.tv/casualquestlive. I am not a gamer, so I'm on a quest to go from a casual to an actual gamer, playing a lot of video games for the very first time, and also talking a lot about Animorphs and other topics. So come hop on Twitch. It's a lot of fun. With that, you can follow the show on Twitch. That's not Twitch. Oh my goodness. Well, we do actually have a
Twitch. Twitch.
We do have a Twitch, I'm pretty sure. But we don't use it. Twitter. On Twitter, we are at 3, that's number 3, Black Halflings, pretty much everywhere, actually. Liv already mentioned the Patreon. Is there anything else to mention? The live show! That's the other thing we need to plug.
Oh my god, we have a live show! Oh my god.
Yes!
I'm so sorry, Ginny.
We need to mention the live show.
Who are we? What are we doing?
Please come to that. It's in April.
Please come to that. It's in April. April 3rd, April 5th in Manchester is the 3rd, and then London is the 5th. Come hang out. We'll be doing lots of goofy fun stuff, actual play stuff probably.
And they're going to be two different shows.
Don't
just go to one.
Go to all of them.
Yeah, brilliant. Go to both if you have the time and resources and money. And try and please come to both.
Oh God. Once again, thank you so much, Ginny, for sitting through our shambolic outro and just being here. And I guess we'll say goodbye.
Yeah.
So long, Shire Folk.
So long, Shire Folk.
You can say the chunk so long, Shire Folk, if you want to.
So long, Shire Folk.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.